The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 271, Early Sunbeams, the First Years of Sunstone. A panel with Scott Kenny, Kent Norman, Alan Roberts, and Julie Christensen Cummings, chaired by Karen Mahoney.
News for the New Messenger and Advocate, which was then subsumed by Sunstone. And I was a national correspondent between 89 and 92. We have four speakers today, all of whom were associated with Sunstone in its early years. And they will speak in the order that they're listed in the program, and I'll introduce them in that order now. Our first speaker is Keith Norman, who resides... Wait a minute. Sorry, I made a mistake there. Our first speaker is Scott Kenny, who has a master's degree in musicology from the University of Utah and in American history theology from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. By his own account, he has a checkered career as a grocery store bagger, a violist, not violinist, with the Utah Symphony and casino backup bands in Nevada, a scriptural exegete for the Church Translation Department. And here's the reason why he's here today. He was the founding editor and publisher of Sunstone and Signature Books. Also an agent and business manager for sculptor Dennis Smith, technical writer and editor for Word Perfect, currently the documentation department for Exegesis Incorporated, a software company for large manufacturers. He and his wife Susan are enjoying an empty nest with a married daughter in Provo and a single daughter attending Southern Utah University. Our second speaker is Keith Norman, who resides now in Solon, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland. He earned a Master of Theological Studies from Harvard Divinity School and a PhD in Early Christian Studies from Duke University. He is currently the Employee Relations Manager for Picker Medical Group's Medical Systems in Cleveland, and he has written a large number of papers and book reviews in Sunstone, Dialogue, and BYU Studies, including the article entitled Deification, the Forgotten Concept of Early Christianity that was published in the very first issue of Sunstone. He and his wife, Carrie, and their four children live near Cleveland, and two of their children are currently serving on missions. One interesting fact that he included in his bio sheet to me is that he was the model for Damon Boulder in Neil Chandler's story, Benediction. Our third speaker is Alan Dale Roberts, who is an architect and vice president and principal with Cooper Roberts Architects. He earned a BA in art and design from BYU and has pursued graduate studies in architectural history and philosophy at the University of Utah. He is the co-author of Salamander, Two County Histories, and several books and articles on history, architectural history, religious studies, and issues. He is the former co-editor and co-publisher of Sunstone Dialogue and has served on several editorial boards for Signature Books and the Journal of Mormon History. He has won a number of awards for his writing and for his architecture, including various Mormon History Association Best Article Awards. And in 1994, he won the Best Magazine Article from the Utah Society of Professional Journalists. And I think that was for your article on the September 6th or on the aftermath of that. And our final speaker is Julie Christensen Cummings, who earned a BA in English and French education and a master's degree in school counseling, a PhD in counseling psychology just as recently as spring of 1997 for the University of Utah, where she wrote her dissertation on the role of emotional experience in psychotherapy. She worked for 26 years teaching and counseling in the public school system, specifically in junior high schools, and then also worked as a psychotherapist with Valley Mental Health for 5 years. She is currently retired. She is married to Richard J. Cummings, and she notes that she attended the second, third, and fourth organizational meetings of Sunstone before it was Sunstone, which makes me wonder about the first meeting of Sunstone, which you didn't attend. Let me turn the time over to them.
Well, by my recollection, the first meeting of what became Sunstone was rather uneventful. We sat around and talked about what we thought ought to be done, what could be done. Everybody was sort of excited to do it, but no one knew how. And then we elected Doug Bennett to be the executive officer and went home. I'm hoping that Peggy Fletcher Stack will show up later because she can make things much more colorful than I can. She's the storyteller among us. And I'm not going to take much time today because you can read all my sentiments in the sidebar in the current issue of Sunstone. What else? What do I want to say? Yes, it's one thing. There's been quite a few sessions this time devoted to the future of Sunstone. And a candid acknowledgement that subscriptions are roughly half of what they used to be, and symposium attendance continues to decline, and heads continue to get balder and grayer, and some people seem to be rather discouraged. One session in particular that I think everyone who's interested in Sunstone should get a tape of if they didn't attend the session is the session that Elbert Peck was interviewed. Elbert is extremely articulate and knowledgeable and insightful. And he gave a great list of the problems that Sunstone faces. And I would say, judging by that list, Sunstone doesn't have much of a chance to survive. In other words, Sunstone is about where it's always been. I, on the other hand, am quite optimistic because I attended another session where people sat in a circle and talked about what was wrong with Sunstone and what needed to be done. And this is with Stan Christensen, the president of the board, and a couple other board members. And we began by going around and introducing ourselves. And after about two of us introduced ourselves by name and where we came from, people spontaneously started saying, well, I'm so-and-so, and I can't live without Sunstone, and then bore their testimonies. And it made tears come to my eyes to hear them talk about what Sunstone meant to them. And I think as long as Sunstone continues to inspire that kind of dedication from people, that it will not only survive, but it'll prosper. The trouble we have is communicating to people the need and the fragility of the continuation of the foundation and of the publication. So, who's next?
I guess I am. I just learned recently that Scott Kenny has been going around giving me extensive credit for helping start Sunstone. And just in case there is anyone here taking notes from the what some people would call the great and spacious building, I would never refer to it that way, but some people would. I just like to say that in 1974, when these conversations between Scott and myself were supposed to be taking place, I was on active duty in the Army, serving my country, putting my life on the line for our country in Arlington, Virginia. And, it just was not possible for me to be that involved, or probably not involved at all, with that. So, for the record, I just want that to be known, and I think that Scott should step up and take full responsibility for what he's created here, just in case there's anybody taking notes. And you're excused now. Okay, now, for those of you who are Sunstone groupies and can't, in fact, live without Sunstone, all I can say is that modesty prevents me from really saying how great my involvement was in the beginning of Sunstone. And so I'm not going to go into all of the details of that. But I just want to say that I did marry one of Peggy Fletcher's best friends. So I think that demonstrates right there how important I was in all this. Now, for the rest of you who I think are probably all relatives of people here, most of them my relatives, I'll tell you what really happened, at least as I remember it. I guess Scott and I have a lot in common. If you read Lee Worthen's article in the New Sunstone, it explains that both of us were in the New England mission at the same time, although actually Scott was just leaving about the time that I arrived in the mission. Both of us, this isn't in the article, but both of us are very interested in music, and in fact, that's probably the thing I admired him the most for and looked up to him the most for, was that he was a violist in the Utah Symphony, and I thought that was, you know, about as prestigious a position as you could get. And so when he started talking to me about, you know, forming this journal or this magazine and the fact that he was no longer in the symphony, I couldn't understand why on earth he would give up that kind of an opportunity and career. And then both of us, I guess, went to divinity school, Mormons in divinity school. So we were sort of a race apart because of that. And the other thing that we have in common is that I don't think either one of us has profited whatsoever from our expensive divinity school educations. So I certainly feel a kinship to him, but in fact, the discussions that we had about it consisted primarily of Scott bouncing his ideas off me, and me kind of nodding and smiling and saying, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea." And he did succeed in convincing me to, or getting me to submit an article for the first issue of Sunstone, which later became the basis of my dissertation. So that was very helpful to me, and was also very encouraging to me in having the courage and, you know, making the commitment to publish. Sunstone was really the first place that I published anything with any scholarly pretensions, and have done so several times since, and that has finally, come home to actually be of some use, because my oldest son is now a missionary in the very exotic place, very exotic mission, it's Salt Lake South Mission. And he's had a lot of questions and challenges come up. I guess probably more so than other missions. If you're a mission here, you tend to run into some very explicit anti-Mormon challenges. And so some of these things have caused him to start thinking about various issues, and lo and behold, there are a lot of the kinds of issues we think about and discuss in Sunstone. And on very many occasions, I have been able to respond to him with a letter saying, "Well, it just so happens I wrote an article on that for Sunstone, and here it is," and send it along to him. And that's happened 3 or 4 times. Last night, after the final session, I was just getting up, getting ready to leave, and a nice young lady came up to me and said, "You're probably going to think this is kind of strange, but do you have a son who's on a mission in this area?" And I said, "Well, yes." And she said, "Well, he baptized me." And I about fell over. I immediately knew who she was from his letters. We talked for a while, and then Becky Chandler, who was next to me, said, "Well, you know, you've been a convert about 5 months. How on earth did you, what are you doing here in Sunstone?" And she said, "Well, I subscribe to Sunstone." And I said, "Well, Elder Norman, did he tell you about Sunstone? She said, yes. So here I have a son here recruiting new people for Sunstone, new converts. So, and this is a young man who, was barely aware at all of my involvement in this before his mission, and any awareness he was would have been probably disdainful of it. But I think there is a future for Sunstone because of there is a real need for it, and it's kind of exciting to see a new generation start to get involved in it. So I'd just like to thank Scott for all the undue credit he gives me, and I'm glad to take it, but it's really his baby. Thank you.
In a way, this gathering here in this room is symbolic of Sunstone generally. First, the panelists didn't bother to get together beforehand and discuss anything about this session, so we have two extemporaneous presentations and two that are in writing. Secondly, you notice that there are very few people on this side, and they're keeping their distance from the speakers. And thirdly, about 80% of the audience there is on the left, and 20% on the right. Of course, from your perspective, it's just the opposite. That's just the way it is here. Thank you, Ardeen. We have the song Choose the Right, but I've always preferred Choose the Left myself. We're sort of reminiscing here, and one of the ironies is that neither Scott nor Peggy nor I can remember how I actually first got involved in Sunstone. That is the first contact. It's kind of one of those mysteries, gospel mysteries. And I do remember meeting them both sometime before the first issue occurred, because I, like Keith, have an article on the first issue. In fact, it's the cover article, which was a stained glass window on the cover, and my little piece was about stained glass window and windows in Mormon architecture. The sad thing is, of course, that we went to the expense of doing a four-color separation for that cover and the interior, which put us deeply in the red after the first issue, from which we have never recovered. So my contribution can be noted thusly. I do have a paper I've written, and it's not extremely long. There'll probably be a lot of Q&A time, but I think I'll go ahead with this. The title of this session, Early Sunbeams, reminds me of a story of the Mormon boy who invited his non-Mormon friend to come with him to Sunday school. Upon returning home, the visiting boy's mother asked him what he thought of Mormon Sunday school. The boy responded that Mormons must believe in some kind of Christian reincarnation. When asked why, he said, "Because we sang, 'Jesus wants me for a sunbeam.'" Think about it. In a way, my early years with Sunstone did affect a spiritual reincarnation. The experiences of these years indelibly changed me and my life. It is good that Sunstone is celebrating its quarter-century existence with such a thorough focus on its history and accomplishments. Sunstone has every reason to celebrate, for despite its small number of subscribers and symposium attendees, which at about 5,000 total equals 0.0005, or 1/2,000th of the total church membership, has had a strong influence in my mind for good on the life of the church. The founders could no more see what Sunstone would become 25 years hence than Joseph Smith could foresee what Mormonism would become. Like Joseph, we early sunbeams were caught up mostly in concerns of the present and near future. Yet in the midst of bringing present dreams to reality, we also found time and had the youthful enthusiasm and idealism to dream of future possibilities. Thus, the early church and early Sunstone grew quickly, evolving despite many struggles. Joseph Smith and Most of his key supporters were in their mid-20s when the church was established. Scott, Peggy, myself, I think Keith, and most of the other Sunbeams were in our mid to late 20s during these Genesis years. While I am tempted to continue this comparison of youthful spiritual quest, we all know the outcomes have proven to be quite different. That is because Sunstone's purposes, means, and methods were very different from those of the nascent church. Although Scott has in recent years spoken of the spiritual benefits of creating another new religious tradition, and those of us like the Mullins, Cummings, our dean, myself, and the study group have talked over the last several years about what the elements of such a venture might include. I think the early Sunbeam saw Sunstone more as a multivitamin supplement to be taken with the church, not in lieu of it. We were all committed to Mormonism and its highest ideals. It was, in fact, our very commitment to ideal Mormonism that fueled our efforts to create and advance a new independent variety magazine of Mormon culture, history, theology, issues, art, and life. Even with the decade earlier advent of Dialogue, a quarterly journal with similar aims, our appetites for a more expansive religious life were not satiated. I concur generally with Scott's observation in his Sunstone Past and Present sidebar in the current issue, and I suggest that you read that. My impressions differ only slightly, and the existence of difference then as now is understandable, given that we all brought to Sunstone our own unique colors, the result of which was a bright little rainbow. We were products of the 60s, but even so, more so, products of Mormonism, which neutralized in us the negatives of the 60s. I don't think it was a sexual revolution, generation gap, experimental lifestyles, or anti-establishment thinking that motivated us. Rather, we combined the best of the 60s and Mormon ideas, which developed in us a hunger for more of every good thing and a more active role in creating, not just consuming, these good things. When describing Victorian architecture, I say that people then thought too much is not enough. That expression may have been apt for us too. We were going to church and actively participating. I was in the Bishopric and High Council during 1975 to 81, my 6 or 7 years of greatest Sunstone involvement. But we were coming away still hungry and not sufficiently nourished. I remember thinking that going to church was like staying in the same school grade year after year after year. We believed in eternal progression, but we didn't want it to take an eternity. I never thought of Sunstone as a student publication done either by or for students, nor did I conceive it to be a junior dialogue. We Sunbeams had finished school and were young professionals, even emerging yuppies, although that word would certainly never apply in any sense to Peggy Fletcher. Our first survey of subscribers bore this out. We found our readers to average about 40 years old. They were well-educated, well-established in their careers, and mostly very orthodox. I recall no discussions of Sunstone becoming a vehicle for dissent or even change. We did not write strong editorials or take critical positions, although some articles began to identify areas of needed church improvement. I find the whispered idea that we were part of a conspiracy aimed at harming the church humorously ludicrous. Naive, inexperienced, understaffed, underfunded, we had neither the inclination, resources, nor organizational skills to foment a conspiracy or rebellion. Yet the magazine did make many changes in the early years. How did Sunstone move to a more intellectual bent with greater analytical and critical thinking and more important groundbreaking articles? I think there were two interrelated factors. One was our individual spiritual and intellectual maturation, and the second was the increasingly high quality of manuscripts submitted, especially after the first symposium of 1979. Speaking personally, part of my growth came from direct exposure to the manuscripts I was soliciting, reading, and editing along with interaction with the authors. New information and ideas, together with our long internal discussions, stimulated my own need to know and desire to research, write, and be a contributor to the body of Mormon thought. Although my earliest writings dealt mostly with architecture, my interest in theology was strong, and eventually my love of history became even stronger. Similarly, all of the editors and board members contributed articles, though Sunstone never became a vanity publication, in my view. I agree with those who see the symposium as being the most positive development in Sunstone's ability to generate much more material for publication and create a spiritual community, or as Sunstone's detractors view it, a subversive subculture. I remember a pleasant meeting Peggy and I had with then General Authority Marion D. Hanks in his church office. We met with him to ask him if Sunstone could publish a talk he had given at BYU Devotional. He agreed that we could, which elated us, but then never sent us the manuscript despite repeated requests, which deflated us. We brought some samples of the magazine and our first cartoon book, Calvin Grondahl's Freeway to Perfection. Elder Hanks seemed genuinely amused at the cartoons, but paused mid-chuckle to make a wistful aside that, quote, you know, some of the brethren might not think these are funny. We knew what he meant, since Deseret Book had, upon initial review, rejected carrying the book because, quote, it might offend the brethren. Later, when Freeway broke into the top 10 bestsellers list, they called back and sheepishly ordered a large number of cases of the irreverent paperback. At the time, I explained to people that Deseret Book needed income to finance its principals. Reality checks came as soon as we began to move away from being a safe, modest arts and culture magazine to a popular publication dealing seriously with important topics and relevant issues. To the extent that warning signals began to appear then, we shared the dilemma which plagues Sunstone today. It is sadly ironic that during Sunstone's shining 25th year anniversary, we read the Salt Lake Tribune article entitled, A Cloud Hangs Over Sunstone, as it marks 25 years, Mormon magazine struggles with its pariah image. I suspect the smiling Elbert Peck shown in the accompanying photo did not write that title. Having shared in the earlier difficulties, I sympathize with the current struggles, which are in some ways weightier and more momentous in scale. This symposium program abstract asks the panelists to consider two questions. How well has Sunstone realized our hopes, and what's been lost and gained? For me, Sunstone has far exceeded my early hopes. I would guess our collective hopes as well. Still, today we are perplexed over the losses of the recent years. The church's condemnations have resulted not only in a loss of subscribers and symposium participants. Some of the most brilliant sunbeams have been excommunicated or otherwise marginalized. Others have heavy hearts and suffer deep disillusionment and dark disappointment. Although Sunstone's very survival seems in the balance, I fear even greater losses as I read and hear of the chairman of the board's attempts to, quote, open a conciliatory dialogue with leaders of the church to make Sunstone more palatable to the faith hierarchy. Stan Christian's agenda is said to be, quote, to mend the rift between church leaders and Sunstone. Quoting from the Tribune article, to that end, he is behind a decision to ban discussion of Mormon temple worship from the magazine and symposium, and is seeking to establish criteria that would ensure no forum is provided for attacking the church, criticizing its leaders, or otherwise contributing to apostasy. I see such goals as antithetical to and destructive of Sunstone's role as an independent voice. If such a faith-promoting, anti-critical approach had been in existence from the beginning, many of Sunstone's most important articles and symposium papers would never have been prepared, and I believe the magazine and organization would not have flourished to the extent it has, nor achieved the great good it has. After having had, quote, many meetings with general authorities in the past year, Christensen is quoted as saying, "We seek and value the advice of the leaders of the church on these topics and find it useful." He adds that if the church had actually wanted to get rid of Sunstone, it could have done so. I respectfully disagree. Sunstone's survival is a direct outcome of its independence. The more it sacrifices its raison d'etre by seeking church acceptance, the more vulnerable it is to destruction, especially by changing its nature until it becomes a different creature and loses its very soul. When hungry, the mess of pottage is terribly tempting, but Sunstone must keep its mission, purpose, principles, and identity in tough times as well as good ones. We do not need another church periodical or a pseudo-intellectual magazine. It is inevitable that the sunbeams would grow up and become other kinds of light. I think we each see ourselves, Sunstone, the church, and the world differently than we did in the early years. Experience has taught me to be more skeptical of the claims and influence of churches. Sterling McMurrin once wisely observed that the question is not whether Mormonism is true, but whether religion is true. Religions are organizations, and organizations are neither true nor false. There is no one and only true business corporation, government, or basketball team. Like individuals, organizations may have more or less true ideas or behaviors, depending on whose version of truth is the measure. Yet, just as individuals benefit from social structures, so do organizations, including churches, need critical observers to provide a balancing conscience and guard against the abuses of power that characterize every institution. I am not saying that Sunstone should exist primarily to criticize and reform the church, its leaders, policies, or actions, but I do hold that this role of watchdog or loyal opposition is one of the foundation's legitimate and necessary functions. Moreover, I believe that it is Sunstone's critical evaluation of and progressive suggestions for Mormonism that are among its greatest contributions to the church, though neither party will readily acknowledge this symbiotic relationship. Sunstone has traditionally valued diversity, difference, and inclusion. The church neither values nor tolerates these qualities, yet it ultimately benefits from the very criticism it despises and fights. We commend the church for the good it does, but it already controls so many aspects of our lives. Why do we voluntarily invite it to also control our freedom of expression? To the extent that Sunstone curries the church's favor and changes itself to meet the leader's approval, which, by the way, I believe will never happen anyway, Sunstone will lose the light which has illuminated and warmed so many for so long.
Amen. I, too, am going to start with a disclaimer and an apology. I'm sorry if that sounds craven. You're responsible. But what I have to offer today is really only a personal reflection on my relationship with Sunstone, not a clear, coherent, fully observant account of the colorful and maybe miraculous process of its creation. First, the disclaimer. I am thinking of myself as a stand-in for Peggy Fletcher Stack. Horrifying role to fill. I was not assigned that role by Dave Barber, but I have burdened myself with it just the same, and no one, especially not me, can really stand in for matchless Peggy. Her distance from this panel is glaring and necessary because of her professional assignment to cover the symposium for the Tribune. And I feel like a place marker for the right stuff Peggy contributed so wholeheartedly to us all. I will try to do my best. My apology is for being a wretched historian because of lack of ability and lack of inclination. I have little memory for facts and details. My perception is holistic. My interest is in the here and now, and my faith is in the future. So history is significant for me only as it illuminates the present and informs the future. What I do remember then, of those early days with vividness, is my friendship with Peggy, who was and is a committed, deeply thoughtful, highly sensitive, and courageous woman who shared some of her personal struggles with me. Those memories have stayed with me. The rest that I will share today are sketchy, vague, and probably somewhat inaccurate, but I hope worth hearing. I'm relieved that no one here was in on those same meetings, so maybe I won't get just embarrassed by some awful inaccuracy. I was there only briefly in the pre-existence of Sunstone. I participated in two or three of the councils held in, I think, an upstairs student apartment, and it was physically as close to heaven as we could get. And then I climbed on the fence and let the really valiant souls who created Sunstone work their miracle of creation without me, while I followed another path through graduate school and eventually into marriage. I had a first loyalty to dialogue, which was my generation's voice. I was probably 10 years older than most of the creators of Sunstone. I was socially unconscious, absolutely apolitical at that phase in my life, and had a love-hate relationship, and still have, with writing. So my path diverged from Sunstone for a while. However, in the beginning, Peggy, whom I didn't know then, called me and invited me to contribute to some brainstorming about a new publication for LDS students and young thinkers. I have no idea who gave her my name to this day. As I was already a follower of dialogue and of a theological, philosophical, psychological turn of mind, I was intrigued by the possibility of an additional but more here and now forum for the Mormon experience. I was probably even more drawn by the opportunity to get to know and talk face-to-face with kindred spirits in those discussions. And Peggy worked her persuasive magic on me. Some of you, I'm sure, have been at the effect of that. When I joined the group, Scott Kenny had already left for Berkeley, and Peggy and Doug Bennett were leading the process of naming the magazine and defining its mission. I didn't know Scott as the creator, or that he was even involved, except as Peggy's fiancé. I remember thoughtful, lively discussions of the magazine's possible content. Alan gave you an idea about that, Mormon history, fiction, theological discussion, and social issues, and its hoped for contributors and readers, young, searching Mormons. But there was not much interest in my passion, the subjective inner experience of being human and Mormon, and the development and clarification of self and values. And I had enough writing to do in graduate school. I remember our casting about for a name, an identity for the magazine. I wish I could remember some of the suggested names. My lack of memory for details is evident here. Because they were creative, evocative, and sometimes hilarious. I do think one of them was Whetstone. The search, and coincidentally my direct involvement, ended when at one evening meeting, someone whom I still don't know, Peggy said that she had a communication, a letter or a phone call from someone whom I still don't know, suggesting the name Sunstone. There was silence when she said it. And then a quick general agreement that Sunstone was a real possibility. I believe we then explored the connotations and meanings of sunstone, the idea of the magazine as a source of spiritual and intellectual sunlight, a symbol of the Mormon past when Joseph Smith was forming and creating a new world and personal view for his adherents, a reminder of a place where contact with God and the eternal might occur, the Nauvoo Temple, and a wildly comical smile on the sunstone to represent the humor, absurdities, and humanity of the Mormon people. And we saw that it was good, and we rested, adjourned. After that adjournment, my relationship with Sunstone was almost immediately distant, but I was thrilled when the magazine was born and thrived, and supported it with a subscription and occasional reading most of the time since. Because I have always lived in Salt Lake City and strongly prefer immediate interaction with real people of like minds found here in abundance, the magazine has not been as essential to me as those of you who live farther away. Also, I don't value distant and delayed exchanges, including email contact, about things that matter the most to me, nearly as much as I prefer to speak, write, read, and discuss face-to-face. So the creation of this symposium in 1979 by the Sunstone people was the beginning of my wholehearted involvement with Sunstone. Because I am now a cultural Mormon, no longer involved with the mainstream week-to-week, day-to-day church, the symposium is one of my spiritual communities, the place where I am encouraged to share my and others' developing spiritual processes in a disciplined, formal, and carefully crafted way different from my equally valued ongoing friendships with many of the people here. Here I am nourished and affirmed as a spiritual being, as the spiritual being that I am. The final comment I want to make is that Sunstone is not in any way responsible for my distance from the church. I wonder if it's really responsible for anyone's distance from the church. I would be where I am if Sunstone and Dialogue had never come into being. But I would have had a much lonelier and an impoverished trip through life. I might have left essential and beautiful parts of myself, my Mormonness, and my heritage behind. If Sunstone dies, I may have to make a decision about whether there's a place for me in the church at all. So, I'm where you are, praying for the continuance and willing to contribute in any way I can. Thanks.
We have more than 45 minutes left for question and answers. So I would ask that you come up here and speak into the mic so that it can be recorded on the tape. Do we have any takers?
Well, I would like to thank all of the presenters for their not only giving us the background and the origins of this organization, but for their frankness and courage in recognizing the difficulties we now have in stating their own positions and posing the problems that face us. One of those problems, it seems to me, is the fact that control or direction of Sunstone has been passed from those original founders who conceived the idea to a board, as I suppose must happen with growth of all organizations. But I wonder if you would give us some little history on how the board was developed. I think I know why. And I assume that part of the responsibility for decisions about the direction of Sunstone was passed on to the board, perhaps to take some heat off Elbert. But if that is so, is this a good thing, and is this something that ought to be changed?
There was a kind of a board early on. I still remember meetings. It's interesting that Sunstone went from Berkeley to Provo. I mean, talk about a quantum leap, and then kind of to Salt Lake. And there were meetings in Provo, and there were people like Craig Call and Chris Cassidy and Scott Card and many others. This was maybe not so much a board as a steering committee, but it became a board. But it wasn't a board in the normal sense of the word. The board, when I was involved, these were like-minded people who were contributing as categorical editors, fiction editors, poetry editors. So these people were reading manuscripts, and we got together and had discussions about the next issue and the issue thereafter and other things we might do. It wasn't the kind of a board that sits around and reads financial statements and divides itself into committees and takes on administrative tasks. I think that after my departure in about 81, that Peggy started to bring in other people and create more formal boards of the traditional type, partly for fundraising purposes, but I think also to distribute the responsibility of decision-making across a wider group. And I think that tradition continued to the present. I'm not involved in any way with the current board. I've never met Stan Christensen, and I'm not really privy to the kinds of discussions or operations that go on within the board. But every organization that's a kind of a cause-oriented nonprofit has this dilemma, the relationship between the board and the staff. And who chooses the board? Is it other members of the board, or is it the staff? And I've seen different models. The Humanities Council has one model, and other groups have other models. So I do. I understand the ramifications of the question, and I think that this board has some tough decisions to make, because it would be more financially beneficial to Sunstone to take the kind of approach the board chairman is suggesting. I suppose that the outcome would be that being more of a mainstream moderate publication, other people that used to subscribe to this people or still do, is that still around? Magazines of that sort, that it would become a more popular magazine and more money would flow into the coffers. In fact, when Daniel Rector was involved, he had a number of marketing campaigns that brought Sunstone's subscription number up to something like 10,000. And the problem with that is that people would subscribe, and then after reading several issues, some of them would have an abhorrent reaction and not subscribe again. So that's a problem. By contrast, Dialogue, with which I am familiar, has a core group of subscribers of about 2,000 to 2,500 who always subscribed, even if it didn't come regularly. They were just supporters to the hilt, and because of donations and other kinds of income-producing methods, we were able to survive even without a large subscription base. So it's sort of there's sort of a financial benefit to making this change, but I think, as I've indicated in my comments, I think there's another kind of loss that for me would be close to fatal. And I'm not asking anybody to take positions, and I really didn't mean to stir up a controversy. I do think that's the current dilemma. What is Sunstone going to be for the next 25 years or the next year? Will it maintain its historic role as an independent magazine and organization, or will it modify that for the purposes of survival and then become a new creature as a result.
I don't know Stanwell, but I did attend that one session where we discussed the future of Sunstone. And I must say that having listened to him, I have a somewhat different perspective than I had in reading his remarks. I also feel much better about the situation knowing that, according to Stan, and I have no reason to disbelieve this, that the board always acts on the basis of consensus. And if you look at the board of directors, that's a pretty impressive list of people. And I don't think that they are in any way the kind of people who would give up Sunstone's independence. I think they're all concerned about the fact that of the decline in participation since the first presidency in the Quorum of Twelve's pronouncement on independent symposium, that we have lost not only the potential of having conservative voices in Sunstone, but even moderate voices. They said that the 1 year they had 60 BYU professors participate, and now that number is down to 5. So if Sunstone, so the question becomes, will Sunstone continue to be marginalized and radicalized, or will it reach out and try to regain its broader appeal? And I think that is a worthwhile enterprise to undertake.
Just for your information, I just read the list of board members and the masthead, and I didn't know who they were. And I have to agree with you, now knowing who these people are. Stan Christensen is the chair. The board members are Martha Bradley, Robin Kanibbe Davis, Eugene England, Marianne Morgan, Louis Munch, Margaret Reiser, and Kathy Wilson. Well, I know. The problem is that 2/3 of these people are women. That's well, I say that because in the first symposium, as someone brought out yesterday, out of 24 speakers, only one speaker in the first symposium was a woman.
She made up for it.
Yeah. She went over half an hour and threw the whole thing out of kilter. Oh, this board, you know, knowing these people, I think I have to concur that... And here comes one of them now.
I'm Kathy Wilson. I'm on the board. Okay, so if anybody has any questions about the current board, I'd be glad to answer them. But let me just explain a couple of things that have happened since I've been on the board, and I've only been on the board for about 6 months. I decided to come on the board because the board was tired and worn out and basically ready for total burnout. And I felt like at this point, Sunstone, even though I have not been active in Sunstone, I've been aware of Sunstone and I've been very supportive. I felt like, okay, it's time for me to put some energy into it. And so I'm trying very hard to put as much energy as I can in the next year or so to kind of figure out what the next 25 years for Sunstone is going to be. And I would appreciate anybody's input. I would appreciate anybody's suggestions. If you have people that you know that are interested in getting involved in Sunstone, I would love to hear from you. I'd like to know who's ready to put some energy in to make sure that Sunstone does survive the next 25 years. Right now we're organizing an endowment committee that will help come up with some money to put aside for the publication of the magazine. Albert's been there for a few years, and I know that he can't stay there forever, and there's nobody out there willing to put in the energy that he's put in and who has really the expertise that he has and has the background in Sunstone. So to find someone that's going to replace Albert with the quality of work that he does is going to be very, very difficult. And so we're looking along those lines. We're looking for money. We're looking for supporters. And I really feel good about it. I was very, very skeptical a few months ago because Albert, as you know, many of you know, has been threatened with excommunication many times. And so the board has tried to figure out a way to kind of keep this from happening, to be, not so much that we worried about it for Sunstone, but we worried about it for Elbert, because he really was not looking forward to having to go through that. Like I say, if anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them, but I just wanted you to know that I'm willing to do whatever, because I feel the same way that everybody else feels as far as continuing Sunstone in the way that it's been able to be an independent voice.
I think there's something quite obvious in the group here. If we look around, there are not many in another generation that would want to, that shows much interest. That doesn't mean they're not interested, because there are some young people here. But this group is we're the people who've done this already. And I can't help but think about Thomas Jefferson's analogy about having to change, and he said that it's just unreasonable, I'm paraphrasing badly, to expect a suit of clothes to fit a man that fitted him when he was a child. And I think fitted is an important word. He didn't mean just fit the physical dimension, he meant fitted the personality, fitted the time, fitted the dispositions. And you people gave us a history here that showed us that there was a young idealism that caused this to come into being. And I don't know whether it's possible to keep that and keep the institution alive. And I'm not at all sure, even though I've been subscribing for over 20 years and attended lots of symposia and given papers at several, I'm not so sure that has to stay alive, because maybe what has to happen is for another generation to feel something that would cause them to want to create another vehicle. Now, but my real question is, has the church changed enough in 25 years that it would be highly unlikely that that could happen with a group of students? I'm very impressed, being a college professor myself, that this came out of students. Now, is there something so different in our culture now that it makes it impossible for students, or unlikely, for students to rise up and say, we have some ideas and we need a forum and a way to express them?
You ought to give the answer, since you're closer to the students than they
are. Well, my answer is not terribly optimistic, but I can't help but think about Václav Havel, who two statements. One, about hope. He said hope doesn't have anything, it is not a prognostication. It doesn't have anything to do with the prediction that something's going to turn out well. It's that it's worthy of turning out well. That's the basis of hope, not that it's going to. He also said that there's something suspect about intellectuals on the winning side, and I don't think we ought to ever expect that we'll be on the winning side. But the reason I'm not terribly optimistic is I was bishop for a few years ago in a student ward, and nice kids, lovely people. But apathy reigns, and so I do. That it's the real question, but my answer right now is I'm not so sure that at least right now, it might take a few years before there would be, and maybe some other kind of events, before there would be a group of people saying we need a vehicle.
Yeah, I think it was kind of our expression of activism in the 60s that resulted in this kind of thing. But what disturbs me about current trends is that, and I've heard that there are statistics to back this up, although I can't cite them, is that the church is pretty much losing the generation of young people who have much intellectual inclination these days. And I don't know whether you can say that that's because of the church has come to be perceived as anti-intellectual, but we cared very, and at least I still care very much about the church, and my attitude towards the church and intellectualism when I was growing up is that the church was the glory of God was intelligence, and out of the best books, and felt very encouraged in general to grow and progress and gain in knowledge. And if the perception among young people who have that inclination today is that the church is anti-intellectual, I don't think there's much hope for the future of this kind of a forum when this generation, you know, drops out of being able to be active in it.
I fear that one of the problems is the church education system, the kind of seminary program my kids went through, and in lots of ways the kind of institute program that I became familiar with when I was working in that stake. But I'm also working with a doctoral student who is in the church education system, and he is an intellectual. And he's a wonderful human being, and he loves people, and he loves ideas. And there must be more of him somewhere in the church education system. And I think that there's hope. He didn't come to the symposium, but he wants a full report when I get back. I'm pleased about that.
Well, I've got a couple of questions, but I'll ask the first one first, and then if there's time, I'll ask the second one. Let me just tell you this as bluntly as possible. When I first heard that Stan Christensen had been called to head up the board and what he was trying to do to mend fences with the church, I'm sorry to say, and I apologize for this, but the cynical side of me got the better of me, and my first gut reaction was, well, is he a mole? Is he a spy? Was he a plant from the church to try and soften Sunstone? Can somebody tell me how he came to be called to this position and allay my suspicions? So, because I don't like being cynical, but sometimes that just crops up. Can somebody tell me more about that? Maybe you know more about it, Kathy, being on the board.
Stan got to know Chase and Greta Peterson, I think, after he moved to Park City, because they had some common connections, I think, through Harvard and a couple of other connections. And so they became good friends. And I think he got involved with Sunstone through the Petersons. And then I think through those connections, they asked him to serve on the board. And then because there has been a lack of energy, I think, in the when I came on the board, I couldn't believe that they even had a board because there was no reason for a board. And I still don't even think there is a reason for a board to meet and direct the magazine or the symposium if they have committees set up and if the board will take on responsibility for the endowment or the financial end of it. Because the decision-making that goes on a day-to-day basis in Sunstone is not affected at all by the board. I mean, we have very few board meetings. And it's different than any other organization that I've ever belonged to as far as board responsibility. And one of the things that we're going to try to do this weekend is decide what kind of a board we want and what are the responsibilities that the board will take on. And I think the major one has to be an endowment. Stan is, even though he may come on a little bit with a hard edge when he's being interviewed and he says some things that I think he says them to make the church feel that he's real supportive of the church. He's not as rigid or as iron rod-ish as you might think. He's a very a one-on-one. He's very, what should I say? You wouldn't think that he's quite as as much of a sellout.
I have a suggestion. Get more women. Insurance on board is
obviously. If you see me over there, I've been working for a week. Greta Peterson has agreed to come on the board. So Greta will be on the board. Is it somebody, Reese from California? Bob Reese? He's agreed to come on the board. Kim Bateman from Ephraim, I think, is going to come on the board. We're getting a stronger board, but I think it's basically to kind of just make sure that Sunstone can survive. And like I said, if we're open for suggestions, we're open for criticism, we want Sunstone to continue to be Sunstone.
Becky, did you want...
I'm James Norman, Keith's little brother, so I've been kind of keeping him an eye on him throughout the years and giving him advice on his unsolicited advice on his articles and whatnot. But I think what's been said about this being having been created and been born in, you know, in the, as a result of the 60s and 70s and our generation I mean, it is really, that is really key, that the world was so different back then than it is today. And we grew up, at least Keith and I grew up, in families so different from what most, you know, young Mormons are growing up in now. I mean, most of us were still of the farm. Keith and I grew up on a farm till we were 12 years old in a very strict, rigid, my mom's here, and she'll appreciate me saying this, home. And, you know, Don and I are still in the church, and Keith and Carrie are still in the church. But the way we raised our kids was a lot different of necessity and of our own choosing than the way we were raised. And, you know... hopefully Sunstone will continue for another 25 years, because most of us will be around hopefully for another 25 years at least, and hopefully we can continue to support it. And but to me, this should be a celebration. What has been written and what is published will never be lost. It is out there for anybody who wants to research it. The metaphors of the iron rod and the Liahona and all the others, they will never be lost. And if the new generations and the coming generations need to find their own means of expression, and hey, that's great. But we've had Sunstone, which has been the greatest thing since Sunday school for a whole lot of us. Thank you all very much.
Well, I see the best storyteller that Sunstone's ever had has arrived in the room. And I would like, since I have missed those stories for all these many years, to ask Peggy to come up and tell us a story. And if you can't think of anything right off the top of your head, here are some suggestions. The funniest thing that ever happened to you in Sunstone. The most heartbreaking thing that ever happened to you in Sunstone. The most encouraging thing that ever happened to you in Sunstone. Do you need any more of a delay?
I already sent them out.
It's Peggy Smith, right? Smith?
I couldn't be on this panel or any. I can't have any participation in Sunstone if I want to write about it for the newspaper, and just finished writing, you know, three stories for tomorrow's paper. So that's why I was late. The funniest thing that ever happened has got to be the fundraiser, don't you think, Scott? The fundraiser. You all know the story of the fundraiser, the very first fundraiser. It was my brilliant idea, I think, to have a movie in the park. It didn't occur to me, you know, screens. How are we going to get screens, plugs, things like that? But I envisioned, you know, 10,000 people coming and donating money to Sunstone. So so we were going to show a Mel Brooks movie, The Producers, in Lindsay Gardens. And, I can't remember. I tried to make some giant screen out of sheets, and I we had to hire a policeman for all these people that I thought were going to be there. So we, because if you have a certain number of people in the park, you have to have a policeman. And so we hired this big, burly policeman for this movie. And we also had the Deseret String Band was playing. And, of course, that day it rained. And the only people who came to the fundraiser were my elderly grandparents and some other family members of mine and Scott. Scott had some family members. I had some family members. We had a couple of, you know, friends and this big policeman. And we held it in a church right by the park. And, of course, my grandparents are not big Mel Brooks fans. And so they were sitting there at this, you know, satire, just very, you know, graciously. There was, I think two rows of people, maybe, in a giant, you know, cultural hall. The policeman, the whole thing, that was very funny, embarrassing time. Another time was when I got this idea, you know, we had all these calendars left over, and... Well, that was gold to me. I love those calendars, and I thought they were still marketable, even though the dates didn't make any difference. And so we cut them up for the pictures, and then I thought, I know, a captive audience, the 24th of July parade. There'll be people sitting on the sidelines just waiting for the parade to come. So I got this sandwich board and put the photos on the sandwich board and went up and down the parade trying to sell these photos. And then I thought afterwards, if I'd been selling snow cones, I could have made a lot of money, but I was selling sunstone calendars. And I don't think we sold 10. I don't know. Anyway, those are some funny times. Gosh, endearing times. I had so many experiences where people would call up and just out of nowhere talk to me about their faith, their struggles. It was like my own personal walking testimony meeting every day of people who were struggling, and they would call up or they would enclose something incredibly personal and wrenching in their subscription renewals or something. Opening the mail became this daily ritual of anguish and joy. God, I have a thousand memories of Sunstone. I hardly know where to begin. It was a very, very good, happy time of my life, which I'm deeply honored and proud still goes on. You know, it makes me feel good to be here among all of you and wear these dual weird hats. But, anyway, thanks. If you have questions, that might jog my memory. It's sad that the funny ones come right to mind, but the serious, earnest ones are more embedded. Worst crisis. Oh, it was always a crisis. Two of the three of the worst. Well, it was always about money and lack of money. There was a time at the Bennett's building when they shut off the heat. That was kind of exciting. So we were each in our little offices with doors shut and heaters going, trying to literally stay warm while we were doing our work. Being the last tenant in the new house hotel, that was kind of fun, you know. There were no other people in the entire hotel, and we were on the 11th floor, was it? 12th, up there, high up anyway. Break-in, yeah, that was scary when we had this art director, Mike Rogan, who had worked at the Ensign. And he was very, very talented. But I think his years at the Ensign built up a lot of hostility in the guy, you know. So he came to Sunstone, and I thought, I'm going to be open-minded. I'm not going to, put too many restraints on this guy. So he started saying things like he didn't want to work like when anyone else was working. That might have been my first clue. Maybe this isn't going to work out so well. I said, okay, that's fine. You need to work at home. That's fine. Just, could you come in occasionally when some of us are working so we could connect. And pretty soon he grew more and more wild and sort of out there. And then one day he wasn't producing anything, and finally I said, you know, I'm going to have to fire this guy. And that, among my most painful experiences, were telling people, you know, letting people go. I remember the receptionist who had the longest fingernails I had ever seen. She refused to type because it would, you know, injure her fingernails. And it took me a long time to fire her. But and this guy, Mike Rogan, he never came to work, so how could I fire him? I mean, I just thought it was really bad to fire someone over the phone, but finally I had no choice. You know, I had to say, you know, I'm sorry, but this isn't working for us. And he was so angry that the day after I let him go, the next day I came to work and, you know, lots of books were off the shelf and on the floor. There were things had been upturned, and my desk chair had been turned over with a screwdriver, was stabbed through it, and the computer terminal was still there, the hard drive was still there, but the disks that had all our subscriptions were gone, all of our addresses and everything, they were all gone. So, yeah, that was pretty intense. The Hoffman era, I remember it's easy for me to remember my wedding date because it was equally easy for me to remember Hoffman because it was 3 days apart. I was married on October 12th, 1985, and he detonated his first bomb on October 15th, 1985. We took a very short honeymoon. We came back. We hadn't read a paper or anything. Went to Southern Utah. We came back. I called the office and said, you know, I'm going to be a little late. You know, I thought they'd be understanding about that. And Scott Dunn said to me, I think you need to come to the office right now. And I said, why? What's up? Did President Kimball die? Is what I said to him. And he said, no, Steve Christensen has been killed. And I thought he was, I mean, it's awful to say this, but I thought he was kidding. There's no way I believed that really happened. And so I came into the office, and of course this was before he himself was blown up with the bomb. And so I started getting phone calls from newspapers saying, you know, did I think this was connected to the Salamander letter? Did I think this was connected to CFS, where Steve had worked? Of course, in my visionary way, I said, of course it doesn't have anything to do with the Salamander letter. It must be his business. And, then, of course, the whole thing unfolded. The police, I actually got a call from Steve Christensen's father saying, you know, it does have to do with the Salamander letter, and you could be a target. And so we didn't even sleep at our house that night, our apartment. We went to my husband's parents' house, and people suggested we have police sniff out our wedding presents because they were all in boxes, you know, all around us. So that was a memorable time. I remember Mike saying to me, so this is how it's going to be married to you, like newspapers calling you all the time and things like this. And I'm like, well, not usually, I don't think. But anyway, those were some memorable times.
We're glad you got here, Peggy. We got a chance to hear from you.
The thought just occurred to me that we could have to get young people involved, we could have a video magazine distributed quarterly that had an MTV production value with 7-minute segments with some really hip, you know, music and language, and maybe an interactive website. Any thoughts about that? Now, I'm half serious about this. I'm going to be 40 next year. I don't think I qualify. I know.
This is what we need.
Yes.
That's all the people. I'm even thinking
when the very tragic event of the loss of the Mullins' son occurred several years ago, being a friend of the Mullins and having been involved with dialogue at the time and having attended the funeral, which was one of the most astonishing events in my memory, we felt the same issue of graying and kind of connected it with Steve's death and created a new category in dialogue, which was to have an article each time, each issue, by a younger Mormon scholar. And the first piece was his fine piece, and it was done in his name, and the Mullins graciously funded an award to be given annually. I think that that helped us because if we, you know, we announced it, but basically it caused us to do some outreach, to actually go out and find these people. As a matter of fact, there are some young people involved in Sunstone and Dialogue. As I think of who they are, people like Brian Waterman, they're basically students of people like us in this room here, students who kind of picked up the Sunstone ethos from professors. I have five children, and they're much more, I think, interested in the kind of production you talked about. My oldest daughter makes a very nice salary in California designing web pages, and although I think of my children as being very bright, they're not intellectuals and not interested in Mormon issues, particularly three of them are involved in the church, and my son is not, and I'm not sure where Rachel stands, but I have not even been able to instill in my own children this sort of Sunstone dialogue, free inquiry value system. I don't know about Scott's children, and Peggy's are too young, and I guess we could all account for our own. Somehow, maybe the failure has actually been in us. I have not wanted to influence my children negatively about religion. I feel that it's easier to have a child grow up with a faith and then decide as an adult what they want to do with it than it is to sort of train them out of a religious, spiritual perspective and then ever expect them to gain it again. So I've tried to really stay clear of that and not influence them adversely or really in any way pertaining to religion. The problem is that leaves a big area of important discussion that we really don't talk about. So I'm not sure where the problem is, but I think for me the answer is we have to do more work to find these people, whether it means having a board of younger scholars, maybe scouting the universities and looking for people to be involved. Somehow we need to do it, or the organization will not replenish itself from the bottom up like it needs to do. Karen, how are we doing on time? Okay.
Well, it just occurred to me that one possibility might be to, if Sunstone would decide to help sponsor some kind of a supplement or section of the magazine or their own independent publication or whatever it was, all you'd have to do would be to put that announcement out on the internet and then see who runs the flag up the pole and see who salutes. We have a much better means of communication now than we did in the 70s, and it might not take all that much if we knew that Sunstone was committed to making that happen. And it may be right now that Sunstone doesn't have the resources to do that. Unless we all pony up our $100 checks this week.
One more question. I was sitting here thinking of my own children while Alan was talking about his, and I don't know when it happened. I think sometime mid or late 70s, I noticed quite a shift on the campuses. There weren't all the activists that there used to be, and the students were seemed to me, to anyway, to becoming more traditional. Alan raised an interesting point that was raised in the Salt Lake Tribune article, and it was Stan's comment that there are now certain boundaries. Number one, we don't talk about the temple ceremonies, and number two, we don't attack the church or criticize the leaders. I myself would like to see a no-holds-barred, totally free discussion in my own little world, especially about the temple, although I know that can never be, because when I first went through the temple, and this was 20 years before Dialogue or Sunstone, or at least Sunstone, ever started, I'm talking about 1956, I was always taught that the Mormon Church is, you know, and I could see just by looking around me, it was very informal, there's no pomp or ceremony or anything like that. And then I went through the temple and found out a little differently. And it just about blew my mind and that was right while I was ready to go on my mission. So I was, some people it doesn't faze, but it was quite almost a traumatic experience for me for a while. You know, if we do get into some of these things, then we get, we alienate ourselves more from maybe some of the mainstream of the church that we're trying to attract, to waken them up to some of these religious issues. So I don't know how to get around that, except maybe we do have to, if not involuntarily, then voluntarily, limit some of our discussions. I don't know. Do any of you have any answers to that?
I've already expressed my opinion on this, but during the period that Peggy and I were working on Sunstone, we did an article called The Mormon Temple Experience by Mark Leone, a social anthropologist. Very important article. This is a non-Mormon who looked at the Mormon experience in a very different way. Lots of very positive insights. Were we prohibited from discussing that topic, that article would never have seen the light of day. And yet, I think it's still, though it's 20 years old, it's still a valuable piece. In fact, I recommend it to anyone still. And I can give, and Peggy, Scott, everybody involved can give lots of examples of pieces that I think under this new idea might be prohibitive, which in fact were very important. And as James, is it, mentioned, we'll be on the record, you know, till the records are no longer existing.
What's the name of the article?
It's called The Mormon Temple Experience. There's, I think, probably a colon and a subtitle, which, of course, we always had to have. Mark Leone, I'd say it was 1979. It has a very interesting cover with red and white. Yeah.
Well, I don't need this. Our time is just about up. I'm also supposed to remind you to return your symposium surveys. And I just want to say in closing that I remember, as a graduate student in English in my mid-20s, getting my hands on the first copy of Sunstone with those gorgeous plates, those gorgeous color plates of the stained glass windows, and how thrilled I was. I mean, my field is 20th century literature, and I mean, it's a field, there's been a lot of magazines started, and the idea that it was a magazine starting in my Mormon culture was really exciting to me. And I mean, I wanted it to stay in that format forever. It was disappointing to me when it became business-oriented and survived instead. So I think I probably speak for a lot of people who have seen it. I mean, from the literary end and the artistic end, it's been a place where people could publish, where people could get together that was simply not provided otherwise. It also in dialogue, but those plates, see, that was something special. I'll close now if you have additional questions.